Good evening, everyone. It's good to see you. Zadie, Henry, Marina, and Erwin, who just logged on. And welcome Toby and Paul, who are with me here in person. And Melissa. Down there. So welcome, Melissa. So we have very good. We have a good showing here tonight, both in person and on Zoom. Welcome, Susan. Good to have you with us, Susan. And we'll jump into the Gemara in a moment. We're going to be on 9B, that is Tes Amud Beis. Very easy to find. It's the first Mishnah on the page. Yes, you'll notice I said the first Mishnah on the page. We have one, two, three, a whopping three Mishnayos, all on the same Amud of Gemara. That's actually a good sign because sometimes, many times, you have a full Amud just of Gemara. And it can be one long sugya. So this is nice because it'll compartmentalize the topics. So that way it'll be more bite-sized. And I don't think anything we're doing is going to be overly complicated this evening. But I, you know, if I say it's not overly complicated, it'll be complicated. That's what happens. You know, a rabbi gets up and says, I'm not going to speak for that long, the Shabbos. And then, you know, that's what happens when we make promises like that. I wanted to follow up, Paul. You had a question last time, and Zadie, I think you also brought this up, which was we're talking about translating, right? That was last week. It was like a while ago. So we talked about translating the Torah versus translating Nach. And what you asked was, Paul, was what do we mean in terms of translation? For what purpose? Are we talking about learning from translations? Are we talking about using a translated Torah for Kriyas Torah on Monday, Thursday, Shabbos, etc.? So actually, it's a machlokas. I believe there's at least four opinions, but I'll tell you what I remember off the top of my head. The Ramban actually says the translation of the Gemara of the Torah is even for the purpose of fulfilling the mitzvah of Kriyas Torah, of reading the Torah in shul. So that, well, there's a reason he's a das, the Ramban. There's a reason why I always come with the Masifta Gemara. These want to give you all the opinions. That's the advantage of this one. So, come over here. Here it is. Yes, it is correct. It is the Ramban. It's actually not on the Ramban, it's on Yud Zayin Aleph on 17a, but the folks in Masifta did us a favor and told us where it's located later on. But he says this is even for the mitzvah of the Torah, whereas the Ran, in his commentary on the Rif, says that no, you can actually use it for the mitzvah of reading from the Torah, but for the mitzvah of Ksiva Sefer Torah. The 613 mitzvah of the Torah is for everyone to write their own Torah. Very nice way to conclude the Torah, right? And so have our own Sefer Torah, right? Imagine, in addition to day school tuition, you also have to buy yourself a Sefer Torah, which is probably just equivalent to 1 year of day school tuition. No? I don't know how expensive the Torahs go for these days. You know, okay, so Harvard tuition, 1 year of Harvard tuition. I don't know. But you know, it's funny. I was talking to the sofer. We had a Pesach fair on Sunday, and I was talking to the sofer who we had here. And a woman said, like, why are the prices so expensive? He said, this is crazy. Listen to this. Now, you would think, you know, supply chains in Russia and this and that. This is the real reason. He said, during COVID, a lot of people died. And so there's a demand to dedicate more Sefer Torah for all the people who passed away. And because there was such a high demand and a limited supply, all the prices went up. And like, that's like crazy when you think about it, no? Yeah. It's sad, but it's like also like, that's like, you never think like that was one of the consequences of COVID was going to be that, you know, getting us, that the price of Sefer Torah were going to shoot up. You know, I mean, in a very dark way, it's very,
it's funny.
Yes. Okay. But then the third approach, and Tari Evan is like, what are you talking about? A Sefer Torah needs to be written in the language of God. You can't fill even the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah. Ah, so how do regular Joes like me who can't, you know, most of us who can't afford to have our own family private Sefer Torah, what do you do? So there's different opinions, but some would say that having maybe a Chumash to a certain degree, having a Sfarim nowadays could fulfill that potentially. So now we have printed Sfarim, you have your Art Scroll Stone Chumash at home. Arguably that could help fulfill that mitzvah. Because if you see, if you don't need a genuine Sefer Torah, but even a translated Sefer Torah could work, then we're not really talking about a bona fide Sefer Torah. It's just something that you need to be able to learn from. And that's actually the third answer, the Touré Evan, which is a very helpful commentary throughout in Sefer Moed here in general. The Touré Evan says, no, it's not talking about reading from the Torah. It's not talking about writing a Torah. It's just about learning from it. The question is it mutter? Am I allowed to learn from a translation of the Torah? And so this brings us to a further discussion about the permissibility of translating the Torah. So you know, I mean, hopefully refer to Gemara Gittin that says, Eslach so slash shem he for Torah secha, that because we were going to lose the entire rabbinic tradition, the entire Torah tradition, had we not written it down, even though Torah Sheval Peh, the oral Torah, is supposed to be the oral Torah, we wrote it down nonetheless, violating the Torah by doing so, because we said, if we don't write down the Torah, the oral Torah, well, we won't have an oral Torah. So for the same reason, there was an absolute necessity to translate the Torah, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to learn it. Now, the question is, does this permit all translations? Most Rishonim think yes. The Ramban thinks no. Why does he say no? Well, if you join me and you flip back a few pages, more than a few pages, to Gimel Amud Aleph, to 3a. If it's too much trouble, you don't have to flip all the way back. I know the art scrolls have a lot more pages. But if you look on 3a, Gimel Amud Aleph, you'll remember that the Gemara told us that Unklus translated the Torah and Rabbeinu Yonason translated Nevi'im. He wanted to translate Suvim, but God said, you've had enough of a field day. You know, don't test me that much. And so Ramban says, these translations, there's a special Mesorah for them. God approved of these translations. But who are we to just come along and make our own translations? And so Rav Moshe Feinstein was posed with this question. And Rav Moshe said, yeah, you know what? Really, we shouldn't be making all of our own translations for Sifrei Tanakh. But you know what? If some guy who is not faithful to Torah, I don't know what he was worried about, like the JPS Tanakh, I don't know what he was concerned about in particular, but you know, if some academic is going to go ahead and give his own translation, it behooves us to write one that's more faithful to the rabbinic tradition. And so on that basis, if we're not going to translate it, then someone else who's not faithful to our tradition will translate it. And so it behooves us to translate it for the masses. So this is a broader halachic discussion, but Paul, because you asked that question, it got me to look into it. And I'd be remiss if I didn't share some of my findings with all of you. So there we have it. And with that, wrapping up our discussion of translations from last year, we will now go into Tess on the Bays 9b, starting at the Mishnah. Toby, is it to the first power or second power for our friends? To the first power, so the first page in the art scroll, folks. Here we go. So here's what we got to know. We actually learned this back in the Makos days. It was toward the end of, I think, Makos as well. I don't know if it's the end, somewhere in it. What is that? Oh.
Rain.
That's rain. Oh, I thought someone was like pulling something. Okay. So basically, there was a special Shemen HaMishcha. There was a special oil that Moshe Rabbeinu consecrated. And this jar of oil was used to appoint all future Kohanim Gedolim, all future high priests. The issue was, if you look at Rashi, Rashi points out that during the first temple in Bayis Rishon, Mos Yoshiyahu, the Eilech Shenignas Solochis Shel Shem HaMishcha, Yoshio knew that things were going south, and he hid a number of things. And one of the things that he put into hiding was this flask of oil that had the original oil from Moshe Rabbeinu. So there's basically two kinds of Kohanim. They're the Kohanim who are the real deal. They were the real McCoy. They actually got appointed with the oil, the Shemen HaMishcha. And then the other way to do it without the oil was Meruba Begadim, that they would put on the eight vestments of the Kohen Gadol, and that's how they would be coronated, that's how they would be investitured into the being a Kohen Gadol. I learned that word when President Berman became president of YU. Everyone learned a new vocabulary word. It was called an investiture. So, yeah, I learned something there. Okay. Now, that's what we need to know. Now, ain bin koin mashuach b'shem ha'mishcha l'meruv b'begadim el apar ha'bal kol mitzvos. So for most things, there's really no practical difference between whether a kohen was appointed with the original oil or whether the kohen just puts on the garments and then begins acting as the Kohen Gadol based on the appointment from Beis Din, presumably. Except for a paraba kol mitzvos, which is if the Kohen makes a ruling and violates something in the Torah, so then he has to bring a special cow offering to atone for the sin. This is only a cow is brought only by a Kohen Gadol. If it's not a Kohen Gadol, it'd be brought, I think, from maybe a sheep or a goat, if I'm not mistaken, as the sin offering. So that's
when you say cow, Moshe, when you say cow, you're talking about a female bovine, or we were talking about a bull?
So it's par, not para. So presumably that, like Toby says, that's a male cow. Is it dafka male? I think so, but I can tell you what's in front of me. It says par. So a par as opposed to a para is male.
A bull would be a shore, no?
The hay at the end is feminine. Okay. Right. So here we go. Now that's distinction number one. Distinction number two. So let's say the Kohen was out of commission. This reminds me, okay, I don't want to get too political, but just to give you an example, they say that, Kamala Harris became the first woman president of the United States because when Biden had to go for his colonoscopy for an hour or so, so from a legalistic standpoint, she became the first female president of the United States. So basically, let's say the Kohen Gadol is out of commission for a little bit, and so they need to put in a replacement Kohen Gadol. And now the president, the Kohen Gadol, is back in shape. He gets back into his job. So what is the fate of his substitute? We'll talk about it more in the Gemara, but so far what the Mishnah tells us is Ein Bekohen Meshamesh LeKohen She'avar Elapar Yom HaKippur Vasir Se'efa. Since the cow that's brought as a sacrifice of Yom Kippur, as well as the daily mincha offering, which required an asir se'efa, a tenth of the efa that he would bring. So since you only bring one of those, the actual acting Kohen Gadol would bring them and not a previous Kohen Gadol. But whereas other areas of halacha regarding these special restrictions, such as the Kohen Gadol not marrying a widow, not marrying an almana, as well as certain requirements for grooming, etc., this substitute remains sanctified by the status of Kohen Gadol, and it doesn't get removed from him so easily. End of the Mishnah. So, there's no time limit that I'm aware of. He served for one day. I think he becomes Kohen Gadol. Yeah. So, but we're actually going to talk about in the Gemara to what extent does he maintain that status. So don't worry. Okay, up to the Gemara. Hala inyan parah. So this is what the Gemara usually does after it says in the Mishnah that the only distinction between these categories is such and such. So then the Gemara is going to make an inference and say, but when it comes to the par, Yom Kippur, Asir Seifa, so we said the distinction in the Seifa, the latter part of the Mishnah, between the current Kohen Gadol versus a previous substitute is whether he could bring the Asir Seifa as well as the par Yom HaKippurim. So we can infer from here that regarding the distinction at the beginning of the Mishnah between both are talking about active Kohanim Gedolim. Just one was not appointed with the Shemen HaMishkan, with the oil. So we can infer that a Kohen Gadol who was not appointed with Shemen HaMishkan, even he is able to bring the cow on Yom HaKippurim, as well as the daily Mincha offering of the Kohen Gadol, the Asir Sa'efa. Good. That's the inference that the Gemara makes. End of that mini section. The next section will bring us straight to the next mission. Masnisan the low Rabbi Meir. So we are going to assume our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Meir. Wait, what does Rabbi Meir say, you may ask? Well, the Gemara will tell us. D'Rabbi Meir, because if you were to assume our Mishnah is in accordance with the sheet of Rabbi Meir, Atanya, the following brisa is going to show us how Rabbi Meir does not comport with our Mishnah. Meruba v'Ganim, regarding a Kohen Gadol who is not appointed with the Shemen HaMishkah. Yeah, I'm going to keep using the term Shemen HaMishkah. Shemen HaMishkah, again, is the appointing oil for Moshe Rabbeinu. Maybe paraba al kol mitzvos divrei Rabbi Meir. So Rabbi Meir assumes that even a Kohen Gadol who's not appointed with the Shemen HaMishkah, he will nonetheless still bring the par. He'll bring the cow to atone for the sin, even though he was not appointed with the Shemin HaMishkan. That is against our Mishnah, which says no. That's a distinction between whether you're appointed with oil or whether you are not. And since we're quoting the Brisa here, we tell you the other opinion, which is the opinion of our Mishnah. The opinion of our Mishnah is in accordance with the Chachamim, that they say a Kohen Gadol that was not appointed with the oil does not bring this special Kohen Gadol offering, because as much as he serves as a Kohen Gadol, there's still something missing. By the way, this shouldn't be such an unfamiliar concept. Obviously, there's many distinctions, not completely analogous, but think about Smicha. In Smicha, right, we're actually going to talk about this in our Sefer HaChinuch class on Sunday morning, because we're going to be talking about Kiddush HaChodesh, and how you need Smicha in order to sanctify the new month and to decide when it's a leap year. So we lost the Mesorah for Smicha. So what I have today from the Rabbi Isaac Elkan Theological Seminary is a degree in rabbinics, but it is not the original Smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu, which limits what kind of authority rabbis have today. We can still inform halachic matters, but we don't have the power to do certain things, such as sanctifying the new month. So what happened was, I don't want to spoil too much for our Sunday morning shiur, that there was a fellow named Hillel. He was a son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, not the original Hillel, a number of years later. So he had smicha, but he was one of the last people to have it, and he saw where things were going. He decided with his power and smicha, he was going to sanctify the months and leap years for all future years until Mashiach comes. So when we decide as Rosh Chodesh today, we have our calendar, it's done on his authority. Point being is that it feels a little bit analogous to me that there was the original Kohen Gadol with the Shemin HaMishka, and now there's like us who are kind of like, you know, trying to fill that role today in the rabbinate as well. Okay, so coming back to the Gemara. My time of Rabbi Meir, why does Rabbi Meir think that there's no distinction even for bringing this cow offering for a Kohen that was not appointed with the Shemin HaMishka? So the Tanya, Mashiach Einli, I don't know what to make of the word Mashiach in the Pasuk, Ela Mashuach B'Shemin HaMishka. Rather, this word in the Pasuk, Mashiach, is coming to tell me someone who is Mashuach, someone who, who's been appointed with the anointing oil, he will bring these offerings. But where do I know that someone who was not appointed with the oil, only with wearing the garments, that he too brings this offering? Tamud Lomar, Ha Mashiach. Why do I have to use the Hey Hayidia, the prefix of a Hey? That extra Hey comes to include another category, which is even a Kohen who was not appointed with the Shem Mishkan. Okay, so we see that Rabbi Meir does not comport with our Mishkan. That's where the Gemara is standing right now. But you see, Rabbi Meir only doesn't comport with the Reisha, the former part of the Mishnah, the beginning of the Mishnah. But how can you make a statement that Rabbi Meir does not fit with the latter part of it? In fact, we might look at Rabbi Meir. Ema Seifa, let's try to read the Seifa together and see, in fact, that Rabbi Meir does comport with the Seifa. And maybe he is the author of our Mishnah. There's background noise coming from somewhere. We could mute ourselves. I'm just going to mute. We're all okay. I think we're good. Obviously, I'll mute if you have a question, please. So, but my Kimdo Lo Karabi Meir, where do you see that our mission is Rabbi Meir? Ema Seifa, if you're going to say our mission is not in accordance with Rabbi Meir, how are you going to understand the Seifa? So the Seifa says, Eme Koi Mishani Shakoi Shavar Ela Par Yomaki Purmasir Seifa. So, what does that imply? That the only two differences between a previous Kohen Gadol and the current Kohen Gadol are these two offerings. So this would imply that for all other matters, they are equals. Even the guy who was only a previous substitute for all other matters is a Kohen Gadol for all other purposes. And in fact, this is the opinion of Rabbi Meir, Titania. If the first Kohen Gadol has some sort of temporary soul disqualification, umino kohen acher tachtav, they temporarily appointed another kohen in his stead. So what happens after he is able to reassume his position? Rishon chozer avodoso, the original kohen gadol takes back his position. Sheni kol mitzkuna gadola alav, the second guy who's no longer the acting kohen gadol, still, except for those two things mentioned in the Mishnah, for all intents and purposes, has the status of a Kohen Gadol, even if he's not an acting Kohen Gadol, Divrei Rabbi Meir. So we're going to read the other opinion in this Braisa, but basically the point we're getting to is Rabbi Meir comports with the Seif of our Mishnah. So if Rabbi Meir fits with the Seif of our Mishnah, well, it's a little hard to understand how he doesn't comport with the beginning of our Mishnah. That's going to be our problem. But because we quote the Braisa, we're going to quote a counter opinion to Rabbi Meir. And this is very interesting, in my opinion. Right? Yossi Omer, Rishon Chozer Avodah. So when the original Kohen comes back, he reassumes his position. But Shani, listen to what happens to him. Eino Roy Lola Kohen Gadol, Velola Kohen Hedyo. He can't serve as the Kohen Gadol anymore, but nor can he serve in any capacity as a Kohen Hedyo, as a regular Joe Kohen either. Barav Yossi, in fact, this isn't just a theoretical, this is a story that happened. Maisu Rav Yossi ben Ulam Mitzipori. This happened to Rav Yossi ben Ulam Mitzipori. Shiro Psul the Kohen Gadol. What happened was that the Kohen Gadol during his time was disqualified temporarily. We knew Tachtav, and so he, this Rav Yossi ben Ulam Mitzipori, temporarily assumed the position of Kohen Gadol. Uba Maisu Vein Chachamim. And when this incident came before the rabbis, and they had to decide what to do with him, now that the previous Kohen Gadol reassumed his position, so the original Kohen Gadol reassumes his position. Shani Eino Roy Lo the Kohen Gadol the Lo the Kohen Hedyo. The second guy can't be a Kohen Gadol. He can't do any of the services of the Kohen Gadol, nor can he do any of the services of a Kohen Hedyo. He can't dress like Kohen Hedyo either. Why? Kohen Gadol Mishum Eva. So we're going to learn two important concepts to know in Shas in general. The reason he can't do any of the services of the Kohen Gadol is, this is called an extrinsic concern. Intrinsically speaking, he has the status of a Kohen Gadol, and he could perform the general services that a Kohen Gadol would, and has the same status as a Kohen Gadol. However, he does not perform any of the responsibilities of the Kohen Gadol, because this would create competition. Because the acting Kohen Gadol will feel, you know, that this is a threat to him. You know, if I'm the real Kohen Gadol, why is he taking my job? It can naturally lead to tension over here. So we say, you know what? Really, you could, but Mishum Eva, don't do it. Where else do we see the idea of Mishum Eva, Mipnei Eva, in halakhic literature most commonly? So we see it in Jewish, non-Jewish relations. There are many halachos that we will do, or things that we won't do, Mipnei Eva. So in particular, one of the most famous examples, arguably, is saving the life of a non-Jew on Shabbos. You see, in general, the halacha is one's not allowed to break Shabbos. The rationale for breaking Shabbos is that, really, I shouldn't even be allowed to save a Jew on Shabbos, because it's not one of three cardinal sins. So, I shouldn't be allowed to break Shabbos. But because... I may have misspoken over there. I shouldn't be able to break Shabbos for any. That's the assumption in general. I misspoke. Why? But so in general, this gets to a whole question. Putra Dehuya, maybe it's different, but just a whole other shir. But basically, this is the assumption. The Gemara says you shouldn't even be able to actually violate Shabbos. But because if I save someone's life now, they'll be able to keep Shabbos in the future. Therefore, I'm allowed to save their life. So it's not that we dislike non-Jews. It's that the svara, the rationale to break Shabbos, save someone's life, is so that person will keep Shabbos in the future. But if non-Jews aren't commanded, in fact, they're not supposed to keep Shabbos, then there wouldn't be this dispensation to save a non-Jewish life on Shabbos, because it doesn't feed back in to the observance of Shabbos.
But it could convert down the road.
Yeah, but that's not really. We assume things based on chazakos. So Paul asks, what about maybe he could convert? Based on the trajectory that he's in right now, conversion doesn't seem to be on the menu. Now, if he was someone who was in the process of converting, that'd be an interesting question, how far we take it. But we have to put things in categories. So the question is, why can you save a non-Jewish life on Shabbos? So the main reason probably is Mipnei Eva, that this is very politically incorrect, I know. That if we don't save non-Jewish lives, good luck having them save our lives. In fact, you'll probably have another pogrom on your hands. So that's one of the reasons, Mipnei Eva, because we don't want to have derision from non-Jews. There's a question, how can Mipnei Eva be a reason to supersede a biblical issue. Well, if you assume Mipnei Eiva is Pikuach Nefesh, meaning nowadays, if there's bad PR for a Jew in America, hopefully it wouldn't lead to like murders and violence, but certainly back when we were under dominion of Christian countries and other places, if there was bad PR for the Jews, it wasn't just that we were going to be on the front of the New York Post, but it usually led to murder.
So this case here with the Kohen Gadol, the use of Eva is very different than the other cases. There's no Pikuach Nefesh or risk of bodily harm here. It's just more of the hurt feelings or whatever.
So that's an interesting point. So Henry says, well here, what's the Mipnei Eiva? Like here's, right, so here might be like not the classic Mipnei Eiva that we think of in Jewish non-Jewish relations, but it might just be the Mipnei Eiva in general, like we just don't want to create tension where there doesn't need to be tension. Now, interestingly, that you say that there wouldn't lead to violence, if I'm not mistaken, part of the historical lead up to the story of Hanukkah, the way that it's always portrayed to me, I remember, you know, in rabbinic literature when you're a kid, it's like the Jews are living happily, minding their own business. And one day this bad guy named Antiochus came along and said, you know, the Yidden are not allowed to learn Torah anymore. And then we fought and okay, great. So, but what actually happened before him was there was like civil wars amongst the Jews. And, you know, people were fighting and vying for the position of Kohen Gadol. It became a political position more than anything else.
All right. Okay.
So in that context, I don't know if this is what they mean here in the Gemara, but it actually did lead to violence.
Okay.
But your point's well taken. Okay. Now, that's why the replacement guy, the substitute, will not retain his position as a Kohen Gadol. However, so why is he any worse? Why can't he serve at least as a regular Kohen? So the reason he can't be a Kohen Hediyot is that, this is another concept we see in Hanukkah. Because once you go up in Kedusha, you do not descend in Kedusha.
But that makes no sense.
Well, Toby asks as follows. Isn't it worse to go from a position of being a Kohen Gadol to nothing versus Kohen Gadol to Kohen Hediyot? And I'll answer you no, and I'll tell you why. Imagine someone is the president of the United States of America, and then after they're done with their term as president, they become a congressman again. Or they just retire and they go to Mar-a-Lago or do whatever they're doing. I'm just saying my perspective is I think it's more undignified. Once you're at the top, once you're at the pinnacle of the government, to then go become like a governor or to become a standard congressman again. Once you're the president, I don't know if you're allowed to legally. Are you allowed to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. We got our lawyers over here. Are you your lawyer, Paul?
I was a politician.
Oh, you're a politician. Oh, I didn't know.
But I have a lawyer.
Oh, interesting. You'll share that with me sometime. So
it didn't happen early in the history of this country. One of the earliest presidents did become a congressman.
Really? Which one?
I don't read. Don't recall.
This is why I have my grandfather. You know, you bring much wisdom to the table. So
he'll let you understand which my history.
A senator became a member of the House. Yeah, I guess a member of the House is like it's a darga, it's madriga lower than senator. Because then you only get two per state. But like it's, you know, a House here in California, there can be millions. So interesting. So that's
John Quincy Adams.
What?
It was John Quincy Adams.
John Quincy Adams. All right, we always got it. Henry, you're always there, like fast to Google things for us.
I think he's right.
Yeah, I admit, bill, I did right? not know that off the top of my head.
$20 bill, right? Is that John Quincy?
I think Henry's probably right.
Okay, soon it's going to be the who was the woman that did the Underground Railroad? What was her name? Wow, is this like U.S. history quiz today?
Harriet Tubman.
I think they want to put Harriet Tubman on the bill instead of John Quincy Adams. I don't know if that's going to happen.
That's just not John Quincy Adams, is it?
Oh, no, it isn't. Right. Oh, wait, who's $20 bill? Okay, I'm going to stop making you guys Google
hold
things.
All right, it's
fine. Okay, let's go for it. Here's the question. We're too
Andrew much Jackson. Nervous
side. Let's
continue. Andrew Jackson.
Okay, fine. Okay, so our question is as follows. We said that Rabbi Meir cannot be the Tana of our Mishnah. Why? Because Rabbi Meir thought that in the Reisha we said that someone who a Kohen is not appointed with the Shemen HaMishcha, he cannot bring the Parabah Kol Mitzvos. He doesn't bring that special offering only for the Kohen Gadol, he says. However, Rabbi Meir seems to be the Tana of the second part of our Mishnah. The second part of our Mishnah, which says that a Kohen who was a fill-in Kohen Gadol, except for two areas, essentially retains his status as a Kohen Gadol even after the original guy reassumes his position. So how do I make sense of the fact that Rav Meir only partially concurs with this mishnah? Is this mishnah according to Rav Meir, or is it not according to Rav Meir? So the question of Gemara is, Reish Rabbanu Sefer Rav Meir, Arachista, in, yep, in Achinami, Reish Rabbanu Sefer Rav Meir. The beginning of the mishnah is in accordance with Rabbanu, and Sefer is in accordance with Rav Meir. Rav Yosef Amar, alternatively, Rebbe Heben Asav Lali with the Tanai. So this mishnah is written by Rav Yehuda Nasi. Rav Yehuda Nasi is telling us, I paskin like the Rabbanan in terms of how I distinguish between a Kohen Gadol who's anointed with oil versus anointed without oil. And I hold like Rabbi Meir in terms of to what degree I distinguish between an acting Kohen Gadol versus a previous substitute Kohen Gadol. End of the Gemara here. Now, you might be asking, what's the difference between these two answers? Anyone wondering? Anyone wonder that? Because Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was the one who wrote the Mishnayos. So the first answer is the ratio is according to Rabban, and the Sefer is according to Rav Meir. And then what's the next answer? Rahu and Asi held like the Rabbanan in the Risha that he wrote, and the Seifa he held like Rabbi Meir. Isn't that saying the same thing twice? Because Rahu and Asi was the one who put together the Mishnayos. So, right? What's the difference between the two answers? So, one suggestion given, I think it's by the Ritva, if I'm not mistaken. The Ritva says that we have a general principle in the second Arabic, based on the second Arabic, and then Vavam Beis. That says Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Allah, Rabbi Yossi in general, when Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, which we just saw in the Brisa, they get into an argument with each other, we hold like Rabbi Yossi. So what's the significance of the second answer? The fact that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi Dafka says, even though in general we hold like Rabbi Yossi, I'm Dafka showing you that here we hold like Rabbi Meir. So that's the significance of the second answer, whereas according to the first answer, yes, the second opinion of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, but it would be superseded by Rabbi Yossi, who holds that a previous Kohen Gadol does not serve as a Kohen Gadol, nor as a Kohen Hedyot. Okay, good. That was the big chunk of Gemara. Now we just got little bite-sized things. So the next Mishnah introduction goes as follows. We're going to distinguish between a Bama Gadol and Bama Katana. So we might be familiar that during when the temple stood, and at a certain point when Mishkan Shiloh, I believe, was standing as well, the only place that you could go to bring your karbanos was to the Mishkan, to the tabernacle, or to the temple. However, during the time when there was no shul available, that's when it was appropriate for everyone to have their backyard minyanim, but now the shul's back, you're supposed to have a centralized place of worship. Okay, I know, I'm preaching to the choir. I couldn't resist that. I'm sorry. Now, so what does it mean? Back in the day when there wasn't a centralized place of worship, you were allowed to have your own private altar in your backyard. But once there was an established temple, you're supposed to bring your offerings to the temple, to the house of God. So even though during certain periods of Jewish history, one was allowed to have their own personal bama, their own personal altar, still they weren't allowed to bring everything on that altar. And the Mishnah will tell us precisely what one was allowed to bring on a Bama Katana. And a Bama Gadola, basically, if you look in Rashi, points out, Zemis Be'ashel Moshe Ba'oda Benov U'Givon, when the Jewish people were in certain places like Nov and Givon, it wasn't as established as in Shiloh, and certainly not as established as the Beit HaMikdash, but it had like an intermediate status. It's better than a Bama Katana, than a personal Bama, but it's not quite the same thing as the altar in the Beis HaMikdash either. So there are only certain things that you could bring on a Bama Katana, certain things that you could bring even on a Bama Gedola, and then, of course, the highest level is the Beis HaMikdash. Here we go. Ein bein Bama Gedola Bama Katana el psachim. The only difference between a Bama Gedola and Bama Katana is that you could bring a carbon psachim, the Pesach offering. Very relevant for us. You can bring the Pesach offering on a Bama Gedola, but you cannot bring a Pesach offering on a Bama Katana. Zaklal, this is the general distinction. Kolshu neder v'nidav. Oh, remember these words? A neder versus a nidava. A neder is I, as a gavra, will commit to donate something to the Beis HaMikdash. A nidava, remember, is I say, Bessie over there, she is now consecrated to the Beis HaMikdash. So, anyway, something that is neder v'nidav karbibama. So if you just out of the goodness of your heart want to bring an offering to God, that you can bring on your own personal bama. Is something which is not something you volunteer, i.e. something that's obligatory, that cannot be brought on a personal altar, that has to be brought on the communal, on the Bama Gedolah. That is the Mishnah. The Gemara asks, Sakim Vesulo, if you read the latter part of the Mishnah distinguishes between obligatory karbanos and non-obligatory karbanos. So why is the Mishnah singling out a karban psachim? So what it means is it's using the psachim as a paradigm. Any karban that is that aligns with the characteristics of a karban psachim, that can be brought on a bama gedolah. So money, Rabbi Shimon. So this is the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, as we'll elaborate. D'tanya, Rabbi Shimon Omer, af tzibor lo hekrivu el psachim b'chova shekavu lehem siman. So even if tzibor can only bring on a bama gedolah, karbanos that are A, obligatory, but also they can't just be obligatory ones, but only the obligatory ones that have a special zman. The karban Pesach has to be brought on time for Pesach evening. So karbanos that are tied to Yom Tovim, their time to certain times of year, those are obligatory offerings that have a designated time. Avachovosh elam kuvua lahem zman. But whereas certain karbanos, Rashi talks about a par helen davar and other examples as well, karbanos that were obligatory, like certain sin offerings that don't have an established time, those cannot be brought on any form of bamos. Those can only be brought in the Beis Hamikdash itself. And with that, that brings us to the end of that Gemara, and we have one final Mishnah. Now this Mishnah, we'll start the Mishnah tonight, and then the Gemara, God willing, we'll do next week. This is going to be extremely interesting because it ties into Shemitah a lot. And maybe we'll do a shiur on Shemitah about this. Next week, we're going to talk about Kedusha Rishona, Kedusha Shnia, where basically there's a question about to what degree is Eretz Yisrael still consecrated today? Now, we have a concept of Kedusha Sa'aretz, that Eretz Yisrael is a holy place, but to what degree does it remain sanctified? So the question we're going to talk about is, when Yeshua came in, I'll tell you what we generally assume. The Gemara will talk more about this. That when Yeshua came in during the first conquest of Israel, he sanctified the land. But then when we got kicked out of it, it lost its sanctity. But then Rambam says, when we came back the second time, the Oli Bavel, those who came up from Babylonia and came and built the second temple, even though the second temple was destroyed, Eretz Yisrael retains its sanctity. Now, Lamai Nafkamina, what's the distinction? Well, Shemitah nowadays is an important question. To what degree is the mitzvah of Shvias, our agricultural laws, biblical or rabbinical? So if you assume that Shemitah is biblical today, that is contingent on assuming there remains a certain degree of sanctity from that earlier conquest. So I'm just whetting your appetites. This will be our Shir God willing next week, but let's just see the Mishnah that basically is the springboard for this discussion.
I don't question about the last subject.
Yeah.
You got these three levels. You got a korban that's not obligatory and not time bound. You can do it on a personal altar. You got one that is obligatory but not time bound. That would seem to be less of a modern Makodesh kind of analysis than something that is obligatory and time bound.
Uh-huh. So Paul's asking is, it seems a little bit counterintuitive. This is just a question on the previous Mishnah or Gemara, that you would think something which is obligatory and non-time-bound is a little bit more personal and should be able to be brought on a bama, whereas you would think the highest degree is something that is obligatory and has a designated time. So why is it that way? That is a great question. I don't have an answer offhand. We'd have to see Rabbi Shimon. I believe it's quoting from a Gemara, Mishnah, it's quoting from Zvachim. Yeah. So we'd have to look at Zvachim, Kuf Yud Zayin, Amud Aleph. And hopefully there, I think there's actually a third answer to, not third, there's another answer in the Gemara maybe offered there. I could be wrong. So great question. Maybe that'll be what we open up with next time. We'll see. Okay. So let's go into the Mishnah, our final Mishnah. Ein bein Shiloh Yerushalayim. So remember, the Mishkan was in Shiloh for a while. All those who are in Dr. Wachshul Shmuel's here, I'm sure you've heard about Mishkan Shiloh at this point, hopefully. So Ein bein Shiloh Yerushalayim, there's no difference between Shiloh and Yerushalayim. Shabbat Shiloh, Ochlin Kachim Kalim, Meisir Shein B'chol Ruah, Yerushalayim Lifnim Min Hachop. So Shiloh enjoyed a status of basically being as close to the status of Beis HaMikdash as possible. And so remember, we talked about this extensively when we learned Makos, that we have something called Meister Sheni, which are ties that you will transfer onto your coins usually, you'll bring them to Yerushalayim, you'll buy food there, and you'll eat them in Yerushalayim. So the Mishkan and Shiloh didn't have walls. So anyone who was basically within eyesight of Mishkan Shiloh, you could see it from a distance, that's basically you were there and you're allowed to eat Meister Sheni. And once Yerushalayim was built, you have to be within the walls of Yerushalayim to eat Meister Sheni. And same thing for lower forms of kachim, of sacrifices. And Yerushalayim lefnim minachom. Ukavakan kachim kachim nechal lefnim minachlayim. But whether you were in the Mishkan, whether you were in the Beis HaMikdash, kachim kachim. So these are anything like a chatzos and ashim offerings, sin offerings, which are a higher form of sanctity eaten by the Kohanim. Those had to be eaten behind the curtains. The idea behind the curtains was in the Mishkan, they had curtains. There were walls for the Azar, for the courtyard in the Beis HaMikdash. So that means not just in Yerushalayim, but basically within the sanctum of the Beis HaMikdash or within the sanctum of the Mishkan, because this actually does work intuitively well, since they have a higher level of Kedusha, they have to be closer to the source of the Kedusha. Then, finally, Kedusha Shiloh, Yesh Achara Heter, after Mishkan Shiloh was disbanded, Bamos were permitted once more. But once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, right, you might be asking yourselves, wait, if we don't have a Beis HaMikdash today, why can I have a personal altar in my backyard? So we'll explain next week. After the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, we did not re-permit Bamos. And so what's interesting is you can actually go to our shul today. When I was in Shalavim, they brought us to Shiloh. Oh, yeah. And so they actually will bring you to where they believe, archaeologically, where they suggest this is where Mishkan Shiloh stood. And yeah, they found some remnants over there. And so, like, we're standing, we're like, oh, wait, are we allowed to stand there? Like, yes, because after Mishkan Shiloh was disbanded, there was no Kedusha there. The Kedusha was only there so long as the Mishkan remained there. Whereas the Beis HaMikdash, even though Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Kedusha there remains intact. And God willing, we'll talk about this in greater depth next week. So again, Shkoach everyone for coming, person as well as on Zoom, and wishing everyone a good Shabbos. I'll take questions, Toby first, then we'll go to our friends on the computer.
While
they were
in Israel prior to the
creation. So why the comparison was Mishkan versus Mikdash? What should the distinction be?
Just between Mishkan.
Toby's asking why do we use Shiloh as our point of comparison? Why not the Mishkan in the Midbar? I think also because basically we wanted to make certain points about Shiloh in addition to that. There's a few, like for instance, idea of permitting Bamos after Shiloh versus Bamos after Beis HaMikdash. So I think that was the point that it was trying to make. But I think Mefarshim point out, if I remember correctly when I was preparing this, that the same idea of eating it, what was the language again? Lefnim min haklayim, it would also apply in the desert as well. The bigger chiddush, I think, also is that Shiloh was like established in Israel already, so it has a little bit more point of comparison to the Beis HaMikdash. That's my understanding of it. Okay, any questions from our friends on the computer? Okay, have a wonderful Shabbos, everyone. Shkoyah for coming, and we have a very fun and relevant discussion, God willing, for next week's Gemara Shir. Take care.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Shabbos, everyone.
Good Shabbos.